Just going to do a quick volume check. That sounds okay, doesn't it? There we go. Thank you for doing that reading, Shirley. Thank you to Elaine and Buzzy as well. There's always a wee frisson of excitement when Buzzy appears. So it's good to see him in 2023. A couple of plot holes in there, though, because I felt that given that Buzzy had wings and could fly to snow, he could maybe have lifted some decorations to the top of the tree. Okay, yeah, Buzzy, right. Anyway, good to see you all. Happy New Year. I'm not here to pick holes in Buzzy's story. I'm here to. I've been given two verses, Joshua 24:15 and Ephesians 1:18. But actually, I'm going to entirely concentrate on Joshua this morning. I just read that verse in the context of Joshua 24, and I thought it was so interesting, such an interesting episode in the history of Israel that I thought I would like to talk a bit more about that. So if you're hoping for Ephesians 1:18, members of the teaching team, I'm very sorry. Anyway, I've got a picture here of a reconstruction of an Iron Age Crannog. In fact, they'll need to reconstruct the reconstruction, won't they, Jamie, because this burnt down a few years ago. And I've put this up here because little fortifications and buildings like this were built during the Iron Age in Scotland, which was something like 1300 to 800 BC. In fact, I think it went on a bit longer than that. But I've put it up there because I think it's interesting how different the people who would have constructed a little building like that would have been from our modern sensibilities. I think it's really interesting just to think about, you know, the type of people that would have put that up. I don't know what they ate, midges or something. I don't know. I've been to Loch Tay. That's the primary diet, I would think. And I've put that there because in Scotland, we were doing things like this, but actually in Israel at the time, you know, this is when the events in Joshua took place. And it's interesting to me that there's a great contrast between what we were doing up here in the northern fringes of Europe and this, in many ways, fairly advanced society where there's a concept of a nation state in ancient Israel. And whilst we can sort of relate to what's going on in the Bible, I think we should bear in mind that still it's a really ancient, ancient document written with ancient, ancient sensibilities. And even though the book of Joshua is described as one of the books of history that are in the Bible, it's actually, I would say, it doesn't function as a history in the same way as we would consider a history of, say, the First World War or something like that. For me, it's much more about the truths are about why we are here, rather than this is exactly what happened. In a way, it's a sort of a superhero origin story. And there's amazing, profound truth in the Bible that I think if we look at it through that lens there to say, this is why we're here, this is how we relate to God. If we move on to the next slide, this is a place called Shechem. And you can see that there are two hills here. And Shechem was really important in ancient Israel. Lots of really important things happened in the early books of the Bible around about this place called Shechem. There was two hills. And Joshua called the leaders and some of the people of Israel together to Shechem. And I would guess there was something about the acoustics there because Joshua addressed the nation there. And I'm really interested in the logistics of how that worked. Like, did Joshua just have a super powerful voice, or was there something about the way the hills had natural resonance that amplified what he had to say, or did he shout something and then somebody 100 yards further on shouted what he had said and it kind of cascaded down? We don't get that detail, I'm afraid, but I'm curious about it. But anyway, this is a real place, and stuff really happened, and there was all sorts of symbolic reasons about why Shechem was important. But he gathered the whole nation, or leaders from representatives of all bits of the nation, and it must have been quite an occasion, actually. This was a time when there was no postal service, there was probably poorly developed roads. Think about this is the Iron Age. There was no logistics network, there were no mini Sainsbury's to supply the travellers with mediocre sandwiches or food. They had to pack everything with them. It may well have been quite a dangerous journey of, you know, a couple or a few hundred miles for some of them to come to this place. It was deemed to be worth the effort because Joshua, so far as I can discern, functioned in a capacity that was somewhere between national leader, commander of the army, and I suppose Pope. And it would be obvious that if he was gathering everybody together in one place, then he had something really significant to say. So the episode which Shirley read to us a minute or two ago, this address to the nation, happens at the end of the book of Joshua. And at this point, we're told that he was about 110 years old. So I think we can infer that Joshua was not a smoker. And because he lived in the Eastern Mediterranean, he probably had a diet rich in antioxidants that allowed him to live a long life. And he's giving what I would call a valedictory message. He's sort of saying farewell. And in the first verses of this chapter, Joshua reminds the nation of Israel of the journey that it has been on, this chosen nation that God has made a covenant with through their forefather Abraham. And he emphasizes that everything the nation has accomplished has been ordained or delivered by God. Every success that the nation has had has been courtesy of his grace. And if we go to the third slide, I think, Richard, I've summarized it here, but actually here are the things that Shirley read out, the key episodes in Joshua summarized them. He said, these are all the awesome things that God has done. And it's God that's done them. It's not your bows and arrows, by the way, boys and girls. It's God that's done these things for you. So he says, he's given you Abraham and his descendants. He raised up these great leaders, Moses and Aaron. He brought you out of Egypt. He sent the plagues. And like I was reading them recently just while I was preparing for this. I was like, that is quite the episode, the Egyptian plagues. Like, that is, I mean, it's great stuff. You know, that is repeat viewing, reading that. He led them on the flight out of Egypt, including what I've called the Red Sea incident there, where the Egyptian army chased them on their chariots, and there was a disaster ordained by God that fell upon the Egyptian army. He defeated the Amorites, and all of these guys in the next bullet point, they were all defeated as well, not through the strength of the Israelites, but because God ordained it. Okay, and I've scribbled down something here as well. There was something about Balaam and Zippor, which I didn't include here, so I'm sorry about that. But there was all sorts of stuff. Basically, everything that the Israelites said could basically say, this is why, this is who we are. We are the people that defeated the Amorites. We are the people that got out of Egypt. God's like, it's me. So, and then we know that Joshua was the person that led the Israelites, that caused Jericho's walls to come tumbling down. What Joshua has set out in this wonderful valedictory address is reminding the Israelites of all the reasons that they had to hope in God. And I think it's really interesting. I think that comes across really strongly in the passage that Shirley read to us a few minutes ago, that actually all these things, they were done entirely because of God, and it was incidental almost that the Israelites were there. But despite God's faithfulness and blessing, we get hints in this chapter and in the previous chapter in Joshua 23 that the people of Israel were not always faithful at following God and placing their hope in him. So, Richard, I should have a slide here with Joshua 23 on it, verses 6 to 8. So this is a previous chapter. I'm not quite sure how the mechanics of this work, because he seems to give a sort of preface to his valedictory address, like this is the support act for the valedictory address in Joshua 23. Thematically, it's quite similar. And he says to the Israelites at one point in Joshua 23, be very strong, be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or to the left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you are to hold fast to the Lord your God, as you have until now. And I think it's really interesting, isn't it? Why would Joshua have to tell them not to turn to the right or to the left and to keep holding fast if some of them hadn't turned to the right or to the left? It's interesting, you know, he wouldn't need to say that if there weren't people that were sort of in some way slipping off here. So he returns again to this theme in the key verses of Joshua chapter 24, where we get hints that they were putting hope in things that were not God. And this is almost, if you move on to the next slide, Richard, thank you. That's great. This is almost the last thing that he says to the Israelites, because a few verses later it says that Joshua actually died. So this is almost like I don't know what my last words will be, but I can't imagine they'll be anywhere near as wise as this. And this is brilliant, isn't it? So he says, this is the concluding remark in his valedictory speech at the end of his life. He says, "Now, therefore, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity." And if I had a bit longer, I would try to unpack that a little bit. "And in faithfulness, put away the gods that your father served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it's evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your father served in the region beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." And I should have put this in bold or in a different color, but I really, really like how he said, "Choose this day whom you will serve. Choose this day whom you will serve." And I've written here, pause. So I'm going to pause. Joshua had observed the Hebrews worshipping idols. And I think it comes across here that he was cross about this behavior. And the speech that he says at the end of his life makes a fairly unbeatable, unimpeachable case that God is a faithful God who always provided blessing. And yet it's clear many of the Hebrews had drifted away. Maybe they were in search of a faith that was less demanding of sacrifices, or maybe it had fewer stipulations about the clothes that they could wear, how they should behave, or even what kind of food that they could eat. At the time, probably the idols were literally represented in the form of little statues, little idols, or maybe quite big statues. I don't know. But it was probably an easier concept to grasp than an all-powerful, but nevertheless invisible God. Isn't that interesting? Like, it seems to be part of the human condition that actually thousands of years ago, the concept of this almighty God is such a difficult one or complex one to grasp because we can't see him, that actually they were kind of drifting away to things that they could imagine a little bit. So Joshua warned against the perils of idol worship or idolatry. The Hebrews would know fine that this was forbidden behavior. They had the Ten Commandments, and the first two of the Ten Commandments were as follows. Commandment number one, you shall have no other gods before me. Okay. Commandment number two, which is a bit like commandment one, number one, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. I think it's interesting that Joshua echoes that phrase there, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, in both the little snippets that I've picked out in Joshua 23 and 24. Now, we are quite, well, most of us have got quite modern sensibilities in here. And we might scoff at these ancient peoples for worshipping carved statues. To us, this is fairly primitive behaviour, isn't it? Here in, you know, Glasgow, where we've got three universities nearby, and, you know, we're at the seat of the modern Enlightenment, we know fine well that little statues can't have magical powers. And when we think of idol worship, we think, oh, maybe of that scene in the first Indiana Jones film where he goes into the cave and retrieves the metal idol, runs away from that rolling ball thing, and then the bad guy steals it off him when he gets out of the cave. And the bad guy holds up the idol, and these kind of like semi-naked warriors all bow down because they've seen this mystical golden idol. And we kind of, it's a fairly comical scene, isn't it? Because Indiana Jones makes good of his escape at that point. And it sort of plays to a certain sense of cultural superiority that we have, doesn't it? We've moved on from this kind of behavior. Like, you know, if somebody came in for a golden idol, we'd be like, oh, it's a real nice statue. So we don't do rain dances anymore. We follow the weather forecast. We don't pray to a god of the harvest anymore. We know about crop science. We don't think volcanoes or earthquakes are signs from the gods that we've been bad. Instead, we marvel at plate tectonics. We understand things better now, don't we? But is it really the case that we don't carve idols for ourselves? I think that probably is the case, isn't it? Like, I don't think many of us have got like the dolphin god. Well, some of us have got little statuettes of dolphins on our fireplaces, but we don't worship them. We don't worship a snake god or anything like that. But look again at the first commandment. It's a bit simpler. You shall have no other gods before me. Interesting. And I suggest we've got multiple gods. All of us are polytheists in this room. And even though our gods aren't in the form of statues, they do exist. And these are the things in which we invest our hopes, our dreams, and yeah, we invest our fears in them too. And Jesus spoke of this in Matthew 6, verse 21. He said, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." And like that verse hits me like a punch in the stomach sometimes when I'm reminded of it. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. I love that kind of poetic turn of it that makes you think. I'm going to tell you now about my idols, okay? And Richard's got a slide here. These are just a selection of my idols here, okay? Right, so we're going to walk through these together, right? So, idol number one, it's the guy in the stripy hat there. That's me. Did you know I was a god? I've got a body like a god, right? So, a lot of the time, I am my own god. It's very, very easy for me, particularly as a leader in this church, to slip into a mindset that says, you know, I'm more likely to get into heaven if I do all this good stuff here. You know, this is how it works. I'll just kind of throw stones of good works at God, and he's more likely to give me access to eternal life in heaven. And then I wanted to find a second picture of me, but this PowerPoint template wouldn't allow me to put five pictures on, so imagine a second picture of me here wearing a different hat, okay? Another aspect of the way in which I make myself my own God is that I try to solve problems myself with no reference to God. I'm like, okay, right, this is a thorny issue. How am I going to get through this one? And it's kind of like, it's amazing how often I just bounce through life without reflection or prayer or recognizing that I have a relationship with the mightiest being that's ever existed. So two ways I'm going to tell you about this one. There's probably other ways as well. Then we've got Borat here. He's saying, great success, okay? And I really like being successful. Like, I went and got, spent a long time at university, too long at university, and I liked doing well in exams, which is part of the reason I stayed. Now that I am a professional, I like being successful at work. I like getting stuff launched. I like getting the plaudits from it, from inside the organisation or from people outside the organisation. I particularly like it if a promotion comes on the back of that. That feels really good. And I think a lot of us can relate to that. A lot of us strive to get good exam results. A lot of us strive to get into a prestigious course at university. It's really, that is something that motivates us, isn't it, is success. Over on the right-hand side here, I've taken a picture of our house, and that represents, like, my house isn't a god. Well, it sort of is, okay, but what it represents there is material comfort. I quite like the quality of life that I have. I like living in, you know, quite a well-constructed house with nice things in it, with central heating that works and double glazing. And a lot of what I do in life is motivated by things like, will this decision make me better off? Will this in any way threaten the quality of my life? Gabby and I have had a lot of difficulty with our old flat that we lived in Govan for a few years. We still own it. We still let it out, although we are in the process of selling it at last. But we've been making a minor but still significant loss on it. And that, you know, just kind of little poke in the ribs of financial worry is something that has a massive bearing on my overall sense of well-being. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. And it's just kind of like the anxiety that builds up. And so we continually, you know, we kind of run in fear a little bit of that threat to our quality of life. So that idol works two ways. I'm kind of like, I want to get more quality of life, but also want to avoid things that might impact the quality of my life. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. And finally, here's a picture of Gabby. Gabby, of course, is a goddess, and she'll get me into trouble for saying that. But we could talk about how we can make our spouses gods, but this picture is the only good photo I've got of our holiday in North Carolina this summer. Okay, I've changed phones recently, and my old phone, like the camera on it was so bad, like they're all smudged or smeared. And this represents pleasure and happiness. I love, and maybe you do too, looking forward to the next big thing. It might be a holiday, it might be a birthday, it might be a wedding, it might be a night out with your friends from work or a party with your pals at school. If I don't have something big like that in the calendar, then my mood goes a little bit squiffy. Okay, I love looking forward. So when the holiday's over, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that does this, you know, the mood goes through the floor. I'm like, I've been looking forward so much to that holiday. And then when I came home, I was like, oh, we don't have anything in. So these are the things in which I put my hope. And you can see that they're fairly stupid things. Especially when you consider the eternal perspective. It's ludicrous that I could somehow try to curry favor with God by doing good stuff. Did you not read Joshua 24 just there? It's God that does all the good stuff, okay? It's not me, okay? That's not how the force works, Han Solo might say. Most problems I can't solve on my own. If I continually chase success, then what happens to me when success dries up? What happens to my sense of self-worth if I ever lost my job or got made redundant? What interesting opportunities might pass me by because I'm so frightened of dropping my income a little bit? I'm sure I'm not the only one that has thoughts like that. What are the day-to-day blessings that I miss out on because I'm so focused on trying to find the next holiday or the next, you know, big celebration? I've tried to be frank here about my idols. I probably have others. And the point is this. All of you have got your idols too. Yours might look a bit like mine, or they might be things like getting good marks at school, remaining popular, or worse, not becoming unpopular. You might be driven by what other people think of you and the esteem in which you're held. You might not even be aware of what your idols are. And they're quite sneaky like that. I'm sure there are idols that I have that I maybe haven't taken the time to address. So I have got some questions here, and I just want you to think, probably silently rather than discuss with your neighbour, because this is quite, these are quite personal questions. But these are questions that I think you can ask yourself, and the answers to these questions will help you identify what your idols are. So they are, what is it that you daydream about? What do you spend your money on? And that will include those of you that do this, your mortgage and your rent. And I would add, I just thought of another thing just earlier in the service, and that is, how do you spend your time? So how do you spend your time and your money? How do you respond when prayers are answered differently to what you had hoped? You know, do you respond with anger or depression or resignation? Then maybe you've got an idol or false hope on your hands. Maybe you've been praying for a new job. Maybe you've been praying that that offer in that house would be accepted. How do you respond when you ask yourself, I must have this thing to feel fulfilled or significant? I'm getting to the end, don't worry. Right, I want to explain something else about modern idols. None of the things that I had in my list are inherently bad in themselves. They're silly, but God gives us big brains to work problems out, and part of living in a Christ-like way is to serve, for me, is to serve the needs of this church. For success, striving to achieve goals is a good use of the gifts that God has given me. For material comfort, again, it's important for me as the head of a family to think about how I can marshal resources responsibly so that the children are brought up well. Pleasure and happiness, it's fine to enjoy God's blessings and to appreciate all the aspects of God's creation. The trouble is, when these things become more important than my relationship with God himself, then these things become God. And I think we can all think of people who've been horribly damaged by pursuing idols of one type or another. If we move on now, you should have a picture of a Golf GTI here. Yes, we do. Idols, they're sticky, okay? They're tenacious. They hang on. They hang about. When I was in my 20s and my 30s, I remember praying and trying to repent of an idol that I called the Golf GTI lifestyle. Part of me was desperate to get a Golf GTI. They're quite cool cars. And I knew that if I had reached a position in life where I drove one of these, then, you know, I would have achieved a sort of level of dignity that would mean I wouldn't ever have social anxiety or, you know, shame when I was speaking to anybody. I thought I had defeated that idol, you know. For a number of years, you know, our cars were basically like a public health hazard because, you know, you ever remove the car seats, you know, from under there, don't look. The truth is that idol has always been ready to pounce. A pal in the village showed up a couple of weeks ago in a brand new Land Rover Discovery with a private registration. And immediately I was like, I wonder what their monthly payments are. That same friend is moving to a really nice house in one of the poshest streets in the village. And I have to confess, I had massive stabs of jealousy. So I think I need to repent of this idol again. Don't I? I need to continually repent of that idol. I want to return to what Joshua said in that key phrase again. Choose this day whom you will serve. Joshua made that address right at the end of his life, but he could have said it on any day of the 110 years that he lived, and it would have been no less valid. The capacity to choose this day is something that God has given us right from the start. Adam and Eve chose to eat the fruit from the forbidden tree. And whilst it's not in our nature to worship carved idols, by blundering through life without actively choosing to follow God in heaven, then we are by default going to be choosing something else. We're made to worship, and without choosing God, we're going to follow something and invest our hopes in something that's going to damage us. Counterfeit gods, idols, will lead to destruction, and we can't beat them on our own. as well as choosing to follow God, we need his help in identifying and removing these counterfeit gods. Remember that one of my idols is me, okay? If I try to get rid of one of idols by myself, then I'm just replacing that idol with me. So it's kind of like there's a kind of like onion layer going on there, isn't there? So we should have a picture of a dragon here, and you can see there's a lion, okay? This is an episode from The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Anybody read that? Anybody not read that? If you've not read it, then go and read it, okay? Right, this is my advice. So in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, there's a nasty boy called Eustace, and he discovers a huge hoard of treasure in a cave, and he is delighted, and he falls asleep imagining all the wealth and power he could have now that he's found this giant hoard of gold. But he wakes up from that dream, and he is horrified to discover that he has turned into a dragon. There he is there. That's Eustace the dragon, okay? And the narrator of the book says, sleeping on a dragon's hoard with greedy, dragonish thoughts in his heart, he had become a dragon himself. And being a dragon made Eustace miserable and lonely. And not long after this period of loneliness, he found that he was getting challenged by this lion, who we know to be Aslan, by the way, but Eustace didn't know that, to undress, okay? And Eustace tries three times to rip off his scaly dragon skin without success. Each time he finds another layer underneath. And Eustace describes the encounter with the lion to his friends. So this is from the book now. The lion said, "You'll have to let me undress you. I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty desperate. So I lay down flat on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I had thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I had done the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker, darker, and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there I was, as smooth as a peeled switch, smaller than I had been, but I turned into a boy again." Now, we know from the C.S. Lewis stories that Aslan represents Jesus, and it's only with Jesus' help that we can defeat our counterfeit gods. We can't do it ourselves. And I think it's kind of wonderful that Jesus knows this and can help us out. But just like with Eustace, it can be painful to give up the gods that we have, the things that we invest our hope in that aren't God himself. But on the other side, there's liberation and there's peace. And when I find on those occasions when I'm anxious about my prosperity or success or something like that, how other people think of me, God has a really good habit of reminding me. And it's lovely that God does this, that he doesn't want me just to fester in my idols. He draws me back to this simple verse in Matthew 11, which is the next slide, I think, and the last one, Richard. "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And I just love that because I think we can probably all relate to when we get really caught up about something massive that Jesus says, actually, give it up, follow me. Following me is easy, my burden is light. And it's so refreshing. Like Gabby and I had an incident recently where we were like, this is awful. And we're just like, let's just give it up to Jesus. And it felt better. But it's our nature to forget that following Jesus is easy, and we choose to follow other things that prove in the long run to have no value. So this is my last point. I've talked too long. I'm sorry about that. Right. At the end of his life, the most important thing that Joshua chose to say to the nation of Israel was the same thing that he might have said on any day in his life. And it was this. It's a message that rings down the centuries to us right here this morning. Like it or not, you're going to follow a god. Following any god has consequences. So make sure you follow the right one. Choose this day and choose every day to follow Jesus. Sit down and rest in him. Right.